Chapter 6, Part 1. Persecutions in Italy under the Papacy. We shall now enter on an account of the persecutions in Italy, a country which has been and still is, number 1, the center of popery, number 2, the seat of the pontiff, number 3, the source of the various errors which have spread themselves over other countries, deluded the minds of thousands, and diffuse the clouds of superstition and bigotry over the human understanding. In pursuing our narrative, we shall include the most remarkable persecutions which have happened, and the cruelties which have been practiced. Number 1, by the immediate power of the Pope. Number 2, through the power of the Inquisition. And number 3, by the bigotry of the Italian princes. In the 12th century, the first persecutions under the papacy began in Italy, at the time that Adrian, an Englishman, was pope, being occasioned by the following circumstances. A learned man, and an excellent orator of Brescia, named Arnold, came to Rome, and boldly preached against the corruptions and innovations which had crept into the church. His discourses were so clear, consistent, and breathed forth such a pure spirit of piety, that the senators and many of the people highly approved of and admired his doctrines. This so greatly enraged Adrian that he commanded Arnold instantly to leave the city as a heretic. Arnold, however, did not comply, for the senators and some of the principal people took his part and resisted the authority of the Pope. Adrian now laid the city of Rome under an interdict, which caused the whole body of clergy to interpose, and at length he persuaded the senators and people to give up the point and suffer Arnold to be banished. This being agreed to, he received the sentence of exile and retired to Germany, where he continued to preach against the Pope and to expose the gross errors of the Church of Rome. Adrian, on this account, thirsted for his blood, and made several attempts to get him into his hands. But Arnold, for a long time, avoided every snare laid for him. At length, Frederick Barbarossa, arriving at the imperial dignity, requested that the Pope would crown him with his own hand. This Adrian complied with, and, at the same time, asked a favor of the Emperor, which was to put Arnold into his hands. The emperor very readily delivered up the unfortunate preacher, who soon fell a martyr to Adrian's vengeance, being hanged and his body burnt to ashes at Apulia. The same fate attended several of his old friends and companions. Enchinus, a Spaniard, was sent to Rome to be brought up in the Roman Catholic faith. But having conversed with some of the Reformed, and having read several treatises which they put into his hands, he became a Protestant. This, at length being known, one of his own relations informed against him, when he was burnt by order of the Pope and a conclave of cardinals. The brother of Enchinus had been taken up much about the same time, for having a New Testament in the Spanish language in his possession. But before the time appointed for his execution, he found means to escape out of prison and retired to Germany. Faninus, a learned layman, by reading controversial books, became of the Reformed religion. An information being exhibited against him to the Pope, he was apprehended and cast into prison. His wife, children, relations, and friends visited him in his confinement, and so far wrought upon his mind that he renounced his faith and obtained his release. But he was no sooner free from confinement then his mind felt the heaviest of chains, the weight of a guilty conscience. His horrors were so great that he found them insupportable, until he had returned from his apostasy and declared himself fully convinced of the errors of the Church of Rome. To make amends for his falling off, he now openly and strenuously did all he could to make converts to Protestantism, and was pretty successful in his endeavors. These proceedings occasioned his second imprisonment, but he had his life offered him if he would recant again. This proposal he rejected with disdain, saying that he scorned life upon such terms. being asked why he would obstinately persist in his opinions, and leave his wife and children in distress, he replied, "I shall not leave them in distress. I have recommended them to the care of an excellent trustee." "What trustee?" said the person who had asked the question, with some surprise. To which Phinehas answered, "Jesus Christ is the trustee I mean, and I think I could not commit them to the care of a better." On the day of execution, he appeared remarkably cheerful, which one observing said, "It is strange you should appear so merry upon such an occasion, when Jesus Christ himself, just before his death, was in such agonies that he sweated blood and water." To which Phinehas replied, "Christ sustained all manner of pangs and conflicts with hell and death on our accounts, and thus by his sufferings freed those who really believed in him from the fear of them." He was then strangled, his body was burnt to ashes, and then scattered about by the wind. Dominicus, a learned soldier, having read several controversial writings, became a zealous Protestant, and retiring to Placentia, he preached the gospel in its utmost purity to a very considerable congregation. One day, at the conclusion of his sermon, he said, "If the congregation will attend tomorrow, I will give them a description of Antichrist and paint him out in his proper colors." A vast concourse of people attended the next day, but just as Dominicus was beginning his sermon, a civil magistrate went up to the pulpit and took him into custody. He readily submitted, but as he went along with the magistrate, he made use of this expression, "I wonder the devil hath let me alone so long." When he was brought to examination, this question was put to him, "Will you renounce your doctrines?" To which he replied, "My doctrines? I maintain no doctrines of my own. What I preach are the doctrines of Christ, and for those I will forfeit my blood, and even think myself happy to suffer for the sake of my Redeemer." Every method was taken to make him recant for his faith and embrace the errors of the Church of Rome. But when persuasions and menaces were found ineffectual, he was sentenced to death and hanged in the marketplace. Galeasius, a Protestant gentleman, who resided near the castle of St. Angelo, was apprehended on account of his faith. Great endeavors being used by his friends, he recanted, and subscribed to several of the superstitious doctrines propagated by the Church of Rome. Becoming, however, sensible of his error, he publicly renounced his recantation. Being apprehended for this, he was condemned to be burnt, and agreeable to the order, was chained to a stake, where he was left several hours before the fire was put to the faggots, in order that his wife, relations, and friends, who surrounded him, might induce him to give up his opinions. Galeasius, however, retained his constancy of mind, and entreated the executioner to put fire to the wood that was to burn him. This at length he did, and Galeasius was soon consumed in the flames, which burnt with amazing rapidity, and deprived him of sensation in a few minutes. Soon after this gentleman's death, a great number of Protestants were put to death in various parts of Italy, on account of their faith, giving a sure proof of their sincerity in their martyrdoms. An account of the persecutions of Calabria. In the 14th century, many of the Waldenses of Pragella and Dauphini emigrated to Calabria, and settling some wastelands by the permission of the nobles of that country, they soon, by the most industrious cultivation, made several wild and barren spots appear with all the beauties of verdure and fertility. The Calabrian lords were highly pleased with their new subjects and tenants, as they were honest, quiet, and industrious. But the priests of the country exhibited several negative complaints against them, for not being able to accuse them of anything bad which they did do, they founded accusations on what they did not do, and charged them with not being Roman Catholics, with not making any of their boys priests, with not making any of their girls nuns, with not going to Mass, with not giving wax tapers to their priests as offerings, with not going on pilgrimages, with not bowing to images. The Calabrian lords, however, quieted the priests by telling them that these people were extremely harmless, that they gave no offense to the Roman Catholics, and cheerfully paid the tithes to the priests, whose revenues were considerably increased by their coming into the country, and who, of consequence, ought to be the last persons to complain of them. Things went on tolerably well after this for a few years, during which the Waldenses formed themselves into two corporate towns, annexing several villages to the jurisdiction of them. At length they sent to Geneva for two clergymen, one to preach in each town, as they determined to make a public profession of their faith. Intelligence of this affair being carried to the Pope, Pius IV, he determined to exterminate them from Calabria. To this end he sent Cardinal Alexandrino, a man of very violent temper and a furious bigot, together with two monks, to Calabria, where they were to act as inquisitors. These authorized persons came to St. Xist, one of the towns built by the Waldenses, and having assembled the people, told them that they should receive no injury if they would accept of preachers appointed by the Pope, but if they would not, they should be deprived both of their properties and lives, and that their intentions might be known, Mass should be publicly said that afternoon, at which they were ordered to attend. The people of St. Xist, instead of attending Mass, fled into the woods with their families, and thus disappointed the Cardinal and his coadjutors. The Cardinal then proceeded to Lagarde, the other town belonging to the Waldenses, where, not to be served as he had been at St. Xist, he ordered the gates to be locked, and all avenues guarded. The same proposals were then made to the inhabitants of Lagarde, as had previously been offered to those of St. Xist. But with this additional piece of artifice, the Cardinal assured them that the inhabitants of St. Xist had immediately come into his proposals, and agreed that the Pope should appoint them preachers. This falsehood succeeded, for the people of Lagarde, thinking what the Cardinal had told them to be the truth, said they would exactly follow the example of their brethren at St. Xist. The Cardinal, having gained his point by deluding the people of one town, sent for troops of soldiers with a view to murder those of the other. He accordingly dispatched the soldiers into the woods to hunt down the inhabitants of St. Xist like wild beasts, and gave them strict orders to spare neither age nor sex, but to kill all they came near. The troops entered the woods, and many fell a prey to their ferocity before the Waldenses were properly apprised of their design. At length, however, they determined to sell their lives as dear as possible, when several conflicts happened, in which the half-armed Waldenses performed prodigies of valor, and many were slain on both sides. The greatest part of the troops being killed in the different rencontres, the rest were compelled to retreat, which so enraged the Cardinal that he wrote to the Viceroy of Naples for reinforcements. The Viceroy immediately ordered a proclamation to be made throughout all the Neapolitan territories, that all outlaws, deserters, and other proscribed persons should be surely pardoned for their respective offenses on condition of making a campaign against the inhabitants of St. Xist and continuing under arms until those people were exterminated. Many persons of desperate fortunes came in upon this proclamation, and being formed into light companies, were sent to scour the woods and put to death all they could meet with of the reformed religion. The Viceroy himself likewise joined the Cardinal at the head of a body of regular forces, and in conjunction they did all they could to harass the poor peoples in the woods. Some they caught and hanged upon trees, cut down boughs and burnt them, or ripped them open, and left their bodies to be devoured by wild beasts or birds of prey. Many they shot at a distance, but the greatest number they hunted down by way of sport. A few hid themselves in caves, but famine destroyed them in their retreat, and thus all these poor people perished by various means to glut the bigoted malice of their merciless persecutors. The inhabitants of St. Xist were no sooner exterminated than those of Lagarde engaged the attention of the cardinal and viceroy. It was offered that if they should embrace the Roman Catholic persuasion, themselves and families should not be injured, but their houses and property should be restored, and none would be permitted to molest them. But, on the contrary, if they refused this mercy, as it was termed, the utmost extremities would be used, and the most cruel deaths the certain consequence of their non-compliance. Notwithstanding the promises on one side and menaces on the other, these worthy people unanimously refused to renounce their religion or embrace the errors of popery. This exasperated the cardinal and viceroy so much that 30 of them were ordered to be put immediately to the rack as a terror to the rest. Those who were put to the rack were treated with such severity that several died under the tortures. One Charlin, in particular, was so cruelly used that his belly burst, his bowels came out, and he expired in the greatest agonies. These barbarities, however, did not answer the purposes for which they were intended. For those who remained alive after the rack, and those who had not felt the rack, remained equally constant in their faith, and boldly declared that no tortures of body or terrors of mind should ever induce them to renounce their God or worship images. Several were then, by the cardinal's order, stripped stark naked, and whipped to death iron rods. And some were hacked to pieces with large knives. Others were thrown down from the top of a large tower, and many were covered over with pitch and burnt alive. One of the monks who attended the cardinal, being naturally of a savage and cruel disposition, requested of him that he might shed some of the blood of these poor people with his own hands. When his request being granted, the barbarous man took a large sharp knife and cut the throats of 40 men, women, and children, with as little remorse as a butcher would have killed so many sheep. Every one of these bodies were then ordered to be quartered, the quarters placed upon stakes, and then fixed in different parts of the country within a circuit of 30 miles. The 4 principal men of Lagarde were hanged, and the clergyman was thrown from the top of his church steeple. He was terribly mangled, but not quite killed by the fall, at which time the viceroy, passing by, said, "Is the dog yet living? Take him up and give him to the hogs." When, brutal as this sentence may appear, it was executed accordingly. 60 women were racked so violently that the cords pierced their arms and legs close to the bone. When, being remanded to prison, their wounds mortified, and they died in the most miserable manner. Many others were put to death by various cruel means, and if any Roman Catholic more compassionate than the rest interceded for any of the reformed, he was immediately apprehended and shared the same fate as a favorer of heretics. The viceroy, being obliged to march back to Naples on some affairs of moment which required his presence, and the cardinal being recalled to Rome, the Marquis of Butane was ordered to put the finishing stroke to what they had begun, which he at length effected, by acting with such barbarous rigor that there was not a single person of the reformed religion left living in all Calabria. Thus were a great number of inoffensive and harmless people deprived of their possessions, robbed of their property, driven from their homes, and at length murdered by various means, only because they would not sacrifice their consciences to the superstitions of others, embrace idolatrous doctrines which they abhorred, and accept of teachers whom they could not believe. Tyranny is of 3 kinds, namely, that which enslaves the person, that which seizes the property, and that which prescribes and dictates to the mind. The first 2 sorts may be termed civil tyranny, and have been practiced by arbitrary sovereigns in all ages, who have delighted in tormenting the persons and stealing the properties of their unhappy subjects. But the 3rd sort, namely, prescribing and dictating to the mind, may be called ecclesiastical tyranny, and this is the worst kind of tyranny, as it includes the other 2 sorts. For the Romish clergy, not only do torture the body and seize the effects of those they persecute, but take the lives, torment the minds, and if possible, would tyrannize over the souls of the unhappy victims.
Account of the persecutions in the valleys of Piedmont. Many of the Waldenses, to avoid the persecutions to which they were continually subjected in France, went and settled in the valleys of Piedmont, where they increased exceedingly, and flourished very much for a considerable time. Though they were harmless in their behaviour, inoffensive in their conversation, and paid tithes to the Roman clergy, yet the latter could not be contented, but wished to give them some disturbance. They, accordingly, complained to the Archbishop of Turin that the Waldenses of the valleys of Piedmont were heretics, for these reasons. Number 1. That they did not believe in the doctrines of the Church of Rome. Number 2. That they made no offerings or prayers for the dead. Number 3. That they did not go to Mass. Number 4. That they did not confess and receive absolution. Number 5. That they did not believe in purgatory, or pay money to get the souls of their friends out of it. Upon these charges, the Archbishop ordered a persecution to be commenced, and many fell martyrs to the superstitious rage of the priests and monks. At Turin, one of the Reformed had his bowels torn out, and put in a basin before his face, where they remained in his view until he expired. At Revel, Caitlin Girard, being at the stake, desired the executioner to give him a stone, which he refused, thinking that he meant to throw it at somebody. But Girard, assuring him that he had no such design, the executioner complied. When Girard, looking earnestly at the stone, said, "When it is in the power of a man to eat and digest this solid stone, the religion for which I am about to suffer shall have an end, and not before." He then threw the stone on the ground, and submitted cheerfully to the flames. A great many more of the Reformed were oppressed or put to death by various means, until the patience of the Waldenses being tired out, they flew to arms in their own defence, and formed themselves into regular bodies. Exasperated at this, the Bishop of Turin procured a number of troops, and sent against them. But in most of the skirmishes and engagements the Waldenses were successful, which partly arose from their being better acquainted with the passes of the valleys of Piedmont than their adversaries, and partly from the desperation with which they fought, for they well knew, if they were taken, they should not be considered as prisoners of war, but tortured to death as heretics. At length, Philip VII, Duke of Savoy and Supreme Lord of Piedmont, determined to interpose his authority and stop these bloody wars, which so greatly disturbed his dominions. He was not willing to disoblige the Pope, or affront the Archbishop of Turin. Nevertheless, he sent them both messages, importing that he could not any longer tamely see his dominions overrun with troops, who were directed by priests instead of officers, and commanded by prelates instead of generals. Nor would he suffer his country to be depopulated, while he himself had not been even consulted upon the occasion.